Hello, it's Friday, October the 29th, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, should parents of older children be given the right to take time off work to care for their kids? Also, will the Manchester United manager, Ole, I can't pronounce the rest of his name, survive the weekend in a crunch match at Tottenham? The Fish Wars, the French ambassador hauled into the Foreign Office after a British trawler was seized by France. The red list, the travel red list, finally being scrapped at long last. But first, e-cigarettes could soon be prescribed by doctors in England to people wanting to give up smoking, even though the World Health Organization says they're harmful to users. E-cigarettes could soon be prescribed by doctors in England to people who want to give up smoking ordinary fags, if you can put it that way. Manufacturers will be able to submit e-cigarettes to the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency to undergo the same approvals process as other medicines. That's despite the World Health Organization saying last year that devices are undoubtedly harmful to users. John Dunn is Director General of the UK Vaping Industries Association, and he joins me now. So your products are undoubtedly harmful, Mr. Dunn, yet doctors are still going to prescribe them to people who want to give up fags. A harm, but not as harmful, presumably, as the cigarettes.
Well, I don't go along with the WHO's statement on that.
Well, of course you don't. You represent the manufacturers of the vaping products, so of course you're not going to agree with him.
Well, absolutely. But I also, Public Health England also doesn't agree. The Royal College of Physicians also doesn't agree. And now, obviously, the British government also doesn't agree. We've had some great success in this country using vaping. It's actually the most successful way for UK smokers to quit smoking cigarettes. And we've got now 3.6 million people in the UK using them on a regular basis.
Well, we've, of course, just seen cigarettes be whacked up 80-odd% in the budget, too. So that will make your devices even more attractive. How many people do you think leave traditional nicotine cigarette smoking via your e-devices?
Well, if you look at the growth of users in the last 10 years, when I first got into this industry, there was about 20,000 people vaping in the UK, and that's risen to 3.6 million. But that's 7% of the adult population. So it's extremely successful, but there's still a way to go. We've still got 7 million people still smoking in the UK, and I think that's what the government is trying to encourage those 7 million people to look at safer alternatives.
Thing is, you don't pay tax, but people who smoke e-cigarettes don't pay tax on them, do they?
Well, they do. They pay VAT at 20%, the same as any other consumer goods.
No, and what I'm saying is they don't pay the huge tax that you pay on cigarettes. Now they're now about £13.50 a packet.
No, absolutely. But if you look at the other nicotine replacement therapies, they actually pay less. They pay 5% VAT, whereas we're paying 20%. But I think the key focus here for the government is really to look at how they can make these devices more accessible and affordable to lower income users, where generally the smoking prevalence rate is higher. And I think that's what the government is trying to aim for with this NHS intervention.
You know what the World Heart Federation says. It says e-cigarettes hook first-time users, and in an ideal world, people wouldn't smoke at all, e-cigarettes or any cigarettes, would they?
Well, first of all, the people that are using e-cigarettes are predominantly smokers. There's very little uptake from never smokers in the UK. So, you know, to say that these products are hooking people on nicotine really is a ridiculous statement to make. What kills you with e-cigarettes is the combustion of tobacco. It's not the nicotine itself.
There's also concern, isn't there, that that there could be health issues to do with the flavours used for the cigarettes. Some studies have linked these to what they call popcorn lung, a severe health problem which can require a lung transplant. Do you accept that?
Absolutely not. This popcorn
I think you
lung.
Would.
Well, this popcorn lung conspiracy theory has been going around for many years, and there's not a single case of popcorn lung from e-cigarettes. And in fact, the levels of these carcinogens in cigarettes are 700 times more than in e-cigarettes, and there's not a single case of popcorn lung from smoking either. So they're absolutely ridiculous statements.
What do you smoke?
I used to smoke. I used to smoke 3 packs a day.
Did you really? You wouldn't be able to afford that now. You wouldn't be able to afford that. That's nearly £45.
Absolutely not. And then, well, that was about 10 years ago. So I was successfully able to get myself off.
And did you give up? Did you give up via vaping, or did you just go cold turkey?
No, I actually gave up using a very basic vaping device about 10 years ago, and that's one of the reasons why I actually got into the industry.
And do you still vape?
I vape on occasion, but I actually vape zero nicotine liquids rather than liquids now that contain nicotine. So I just do it for pleasure.
All right. Just finally, Mr. Dunn, when do you think, if it does happen, they get the NHS license, it, how quickly do you think this could happen? And will it happen in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland too?
Well, it's hard to tell with the other jurisdictions, but if you look at the current process, nothing is going to happen quickly. And in fact, you know, doctors at the moment can already tell their patients to go and use e-cigarettes. About 30% of the NHS stop smoking clinics around the country are already doing that. So there's nothing stopping people already making the switch. But what you'll find with this process, it does take a number of years for a product to go through, and there is significant cost, which is one of the reasons why it's never been done. But what we need to take a look at now is if the government has actually changed the current process to make it more streamlined to allow products to go through that process quicker. And I think that's what we've got to look at in more detail.
That's John Dunn. He's Director General of the UK Vaping Industries Association. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. So there's a diplomatic war of words now between Britain and France after the French authorities impounded a British trawler in Le Havre in the latest dispute over trawler fishing rights. The British government says they can respond, they can do tit for tat, and the French ambassador has been called into the Foreign Office today to what they say in diplomatic circles is to be given a dressing down. Barry Dees is the chief executive of the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations and joins me now. Mr. Dees, this is all post-Brexit wrangling, of course, and I'm pretty sure that the fact Macron, the French president, has got a tricky election next April is a big factor in why this has all flared up again.
I think that is right. I don't really think this dispute makes sense in terms of fishing alone. The very belligerent rhetoric that's coming out of France suggests that this is not normal enforcement behavior pattern, the impoundment of these vessels. That something else is going on, and I think you're quite right. It's the explanation really lies with domestic French politics.
The British government, they insist that the French trawlers that have been refused licenses have either haven't done the paperwork correctly, and we've seen all that going on, of course, in Northern Ireland, and France have been very keen that this paperwork is all done properly between Britain and Northern Ireland. But also they say some of these boats were never entitled to licenses in the first place. But there's a very small number of trawlers involved in this dispute.
Yeah, my understanding is that if you look at the licenses that have been granted to the EU fleet, it's something like 98% of them have been granted. It's not unusual for where there's a reference period and qualifying criteria for there to be residual issues with a minority of vessels. We have this, you know, equally in domestic situations. So, but the trade and cooperation agreement is quite clear that evidence is required to demonstrate that these vessels have fished during a reference period in the past, or they're not eligible. And I think this is a technical issue that is being resolved. But it'll be a mixture of kind of difficult borderline cases and some opportunists that are trying to get in under the bar because it's economically beneficial for them to do so. So I think, but this is something that ought to be resolved at the technical level. It's got no business being elevated up to high politics.
There was talk as well earlier in the week, you'll have seen it, Mr. Dees, it's your world, of course, that that France could ban British seafood exports going into France. That's a £560 million export industry. I'm sure that's not going to happen. Britain says they can retaliate too. What could we do?
Well, it's a strange one because it would hurt both sides, the businesses in the supply chain for fisheries products on both sides of the channel that rely on this trade to take place. I mean, there's something like 5,000 jobs in Boulogne-sur-Mer dependent on this trade. So it's a strange one to threaten that. I hope it doesn't move into that kind of realm. It would certainly be damaging, but it would be damaging for both sides.
Indeed. You're pretty confident, aren't you, that this is all going to be resolved?
I'm hopeful. I'm not confident of anything because my realm is fishing and fishing politics, and this is way beyond that. And that's really what worries me, that this is the language that's being used, the rhetoric, has got nothing to do with fishing or fishing politics. It's everything to do with high politics, and I think the election, Macron's election next year.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, I should say just finally, the slight worry for you will be that election's not till next year. How many more times is this going to flare up?
Well, that has to be a concern, but I think, as I've tried to point out, everything that's been suggested has got two sides to it. That, you know, if we go down the road of having zero tolerance, tit for tat enforcement, the French fleets fish much more in our waters than we fish in theirs. So it's not really something that's worth contemplating.
Fascinating. That's Barry Dees, who's the Chief Executive of the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our podcast and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The remaining seven countries on the UK government's much maligned and much mocked COVID travel red list is being removed from next week. It'll be the first time since February that travellers can go anywhere in the world without the threat of costly hotel quarantine on return. But the government say the red list system is going to be kept in reserve and countries could be added back if cases rise. Paul Charles from the PC agency has led the battle to get the red list reduced, cut and finally removed, and he joins me now. Did you think it would take this long?
I didn't, Andrew. I have to admit, I thought it would be over and done with much sooner, but I guess it's a learning from this pandemic that, in fact, all pandemics take at least 18 months to 2 years to sort of go through the system. So I suppose we should be grateful for small mercies that list is now zero, and the worst thing the government could do, of course, is to put countries back onto that red list. I hope they don't.
So we now know there'll be no more quarantines, but what about the baffling tests that people have to have, the PCR tests? Are they still in place in various countries, or do they get swept away too?
We're still in a position where you really have to do a lot of research before you travel. So the country you're traveling to might want proof of a test, even if you are fully vaccinated. And of course, when you come back to the UK, you need to take a test on day two or before day two once you've arrived in the UK. So there is still quite a lot of testing. And for some people, it's still too much of a hassle and a barrier to travel. But to be fair, the industry is picking up. There are more bookings coming through. Airlines are starting to see swathes of people return. And I think we'll be back to near normal by around summer of next year if things carry on according to plan.
And we often talk, Paul, about people flying out on holidays to Spain, the hot spots, winter sun and all that. But a very important part of the aviation industry and, of course, the British hospitality industry and tourism industry is inward travel to the United Kingdom. Mm. Are those flights picking up?
Inbound travel is critical. It adds billions to our economy, not just to the travel economy, wider GDP. And yes, we are seeing more people come in, especially Americans, which of course are big spenders in the UK market. You only have to talk to a taxi driver to tell you the Americans are back. They're starting to splash the cash again, but still not to the level we'd expect. And I think that will pick up after November the 8th, when the US itself opens up more to UK citizens and allows them in, even if they've been fully jabbed, with proof of a test. So we're starting to see bit by bit things improve. But when you look back, this red list policy has been, it's caused huge distress. It's something we never want to see again. 203,000 people have stayed in hotel quarantine in the UK since February when it came in, and each paying an average of £2,000 for their 11-night stay. So the government's had income of over £400 million from this policy. They haven't made a profit of that amount, but they've certainly profited from this policy. And no wonder, therefore, they've had it for so long.
How did they get that £400 million? How does that practically work then, Paul?
So when I check into a hotel under the quarantine system, if I've come from this country, then I would be paying, when the scheme started, around £1,800 per person. Now, until it's removed on Monday, you'd be paying £2,300 per person. So the average is around £2,000. That does include your food, of course, although the quality of the food is debatable. And the government would have obviously spent some of that money coming in on security, on the food itself. Some of the money would have gone to the hotels. But I bet your bottom dollar the government has made a sizable profit in some way from this scheme. And if they haven't made a profit, it's been badly managed.
I think it needs a freedom of information request, don't you?
I think it needs following up further. And it'd be interesting to see what the government say to that. But 400 million, I mean, it's an extraordinary amount that has been brought into the government's coffers from this red list scheme.
And just finally, Paul, it was the most draconian restrictions of anywhere in Europe, weren't they? The red list?
They were strong, that's for sure. Ireland actually had some pretty strong restrictions in place throughout much of the pandemic, but the UK was up there and has certainly been up there in terms of the length of time these restrictions have been in place, that even though Ireland and Australia removed their red lists a month ago, the UK hung in there even 2 weeks ago when they removed so many countries from the red list. They had to keep, for some bizarre reason, seven countries still on that red list, and no one knows why. There's been a total lack of transparency throughout over the red list system, and I hope the independent committee and commission that looks into the handling of the pandemic by the UK government will look into this particular scheme in detail, because we still don't understand how so many countries ended up on the red list for no reason.
Very interesting. Paul Charles from the PC Agency. Great to talk to you as ever. The message is don't risk swimming in Britain's rivers. That's the message from one of the Environment Agency bosses after data shows water companies dumped raw sewage into England's rivers and seas more than 400,000 times last year. Campaigners are now calling for water companies to be better monitored over concerns for wildlife and the environment. Dr. Paul Johnson is chief scientist at the Greenpeace Labs at the University of Exeter and joins me now. Dr. Johnson, this is a story that frankly is scandalous. This has been going on for some years, I gather, and it's because although water companies are then fined by whatever agency it is, the fine is considerably less than what it would cost them to put in proper infrastructure to deal with all this raw sewage.
Yeah, well, there is an element of accepting fines as costs of doing business, which is, of course, quite unacceptable. But there are a number of dimensions to this problem. I mean, we have sewage discharges going into rivers and into the sea, and raw sewage discharges at that. And we also have the issue of agricultural runoff. And there's a lot of bacteriological degradation of rivers due to that particular factor as well. But yes, what needs to happen is the investment that hasn't been made over the last 30 years that I've been following the issue needs to be made with some urgency. It is a scandal. I mean, it's not really acceptable to be pumping raw sewage into your inland waters and coastal waters.
And we're being told as well, by the way, that we shouldn't be swimming in the rivers because they're not for us. They're for fish. But I shouldn't think the sewage is doing much good for the fish either.
Well, it doesn't, and it also comes into the system contaminated with chemicals, which also don't do much good to the fish. So there's a number of factors, again, at play here. It's quite a complicated situation, but certainly in relation to bacteriological quality and the possibility of picking up a gut infection or something worse, no, you shouldn't really be swimming in the rivers if you value your health. It's not a clever thing to do. And it's not just sewage. It must be said that there are other rat-borne diseases like Viles disease, for example, that you can pick up from swimming in a river, which, is not something that you really want to chance your arm with.
Is the big problem, or one of the problems here, Doctor, that water companies have been self-monitoring since 2010, monitoring may be limited, and who's checking their monitoring?
Well, that is also another problem, and I mean, self-monitoring has been a considerable problem in my view. What we have is essentially an environment agency that has been progressively cut back, and perhaps 50% of its funding for enforcement has gone since 2010. Well, unless you've got sound infrastructure, a sound regulatory structure, and someone to enforce it, it's inevitable, I think, that things are going to get missed. And the number of enforcement calls that the environment agencies are able to make at the current level of funding simply isn't enough to provide adequate policing of the discharge and the discharge qualities.
And we've seen Parliament, and it's worse than at its best, haven't we, in the last week or so, because the House of Lords intervened to stop this, to try to stop this. The House of Commons overturned what the House of Lords did. House of Lords have put it back, and the House of Commons we now think is going to back off because of a prospect of a Tory rebellion, because many of these rivers are in, well, it doesn't matter where they are, but many Tory MPs will think this could affect my majority at my election if my constituents discover I've effectively sanctioned raw sewage being pumped into their local river.
I think the prospect of a rebellion is probably to the forefront of the thinking on this one, and there's the possibility that the government will back away from defanging the legislation, so to speak. So, as I say, what needs to happen is the investment needs to be made to improve the infrastructure, and all the indications are that it wouldn't be as expensive as the government have been claiming. It could, and the thing is, if you do it incrementally, but at a reasonable rate, then it wouldn't take long to sort this out. To be fair, it's not just a problem with Victorian infrastructure, which is being claimed as behind all of this. It's come from years and years and years of serial lack of investment, and we need to have that investment cycle retuned, recalibrated, and made to move to stop this sort of thing happening. We've got to take into account the populations are increasing. We've also got to take into account the fact that rainfall periods are becoming much more intense over much shorter periods, which makes these combined sewage outflows, overflows, that much more likely to swing into action. But let's face it, I mean, even on the River Thames, which has been purportedly cleaned up to some degree, we're still having at certain times of weather conditions and tide to put a barge up and down the river that pumps oxygen into it in order to maintain the biological quality, because it's so prone to getting an oxygen sag. And of course, nothing can live in water or on land without breathing oxygen.
Fascinating stuff. Dr. Johnson, thanks so much for joining us. He's the chief scientist at the Greenpeace Labs at the University of Exeter. So think very carefully next time you dip your toe in your local river. That's what I would say. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's here with the latest sports news. Big game for that Man United manager, who I think can have a job as an extra in the next Lord of the Rings film if he gets sacked, Matt.
Indeed, and if it doesn't go well tomorrow for him, then it may well be heading for Hobbit Land, because it's huge. You know, this is a massive game for him after all the commotion last weekend when Man United were soundly beaten at home by their arch rivals Liverpool. If it goes badly wrong tomorrow when they play against Tottenham, then, you know, the pressure was immense at the start of this week on him, and a lot of people thought he could have gone, you know, on Monday or Tuesday. United have decided after board meetings on Monday to stick with him for the time being, but he can barely afford to have another horror show like he had last weekend. So that makes the game at Tottenham a massive game. Now, Tottenham aren't in great form, but, you know, if Kane were to bag three goals and Man United go down heavily, you know, it's hard to see him staying in the job. Also, he's got some horror fixtures coming up after this one. So he really could do with arresting the slide and getting a good result against Tottenham on Saturday.
And finally, Matt, England taking on Australia in the cricket. We've done quite well so far, haven't we? We've won our first two matches. It's the Team 20 overs competition, isn't it?
Yes, it's the World Cup, the T20 World Cup. And this is on tomorrow as well. I mean, you could, I know you would want to, I'm not sure what else you've got on tomorrow, but you could probably pretty much sit down at midday tomorrow and watch sport all the way through till about 7:30. You could start with Arsenal-Leicester, then go into the England v Australia in the T20 World Cup, and then you could almost bounce straight into Tottenham against Man U. So, so your middle bit of that sporting feast would be is the England v Australia. So always in cricket is a massive fixture, whether it's T20, whether it's an Ashes test, and both teams have won both their fixtures so far, and this is their biggest test for both of them so far, to see, you know, that they're already been talked of as a couple of the favorites to win the whole thing. Well, tomorrow will give us a good show of where they're at now. England are battle hardened, they've played a lot of cricket lately. Australia have played less due to COVID and their fixture list being rearranged and stuff like that. So they're a little bit more undercooked, you might say. So it's a tough one to call. T20s are always difficult, but I fancy England to win this one and set down a marker as they go on to try to win the whole thing.
All right, Matt, and as tempting as it is to watch it, I have got a more interesting appointment. I'm going to watch some paint dry.
Unbelievable. Well, you don't know what you're missing.
All right, then. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood, always here, trying to convert me to the joys of sport. He does his best. So should parents of older children be given the right to take time off work to care for their kids? So-called teen-ternity is being proposed by campaigners who say increasing numbers of parents are being forced to pick between their careers and caring for teens with physical or mental illnesses. Tanith Carey spoke to some parents in this situation, and she joins me now. Tanith, it's a new one on me, teen-ternity. You're a mum. Is it something you recognise?
I absolutely do. I mean, we give maternity leave for mothers or parents when they have babies, but actually when you have a teenager, they're not only bigger in size, but their problems are much bigger and can really affect their future. So I think there has to be a little bit of a shift in the conversation. At the moment, we have a mental health crisis in this country with our adolescents. We've got a figure whereby 1 in 10 children in this country seem to have some sort of mental health issue of some kind, and obviously the system just can't cope. So what we need to do is allow parents to step in, an army of parents who have the freedom and flexibility to actually tend to this, because otherwise, further down the line, it's going to cost the government and our welfare structure a lot more money than it is now.
I was going to say, the point is, though, if parents want to perhaps take, what is it, 6 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks leave to look after their child, are they going to expect the employer to pay, the government to pay? Who pays for them to have that time at home?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that financially it's very challenging. So I think that there are actually things in place which are probably not used enough. So, for example, you know, flexible working. Everybody who's been with their employer for a certain amount of time can work flexibly. I think there needs to be more work. It shouldn't just be down to mothers. It should be down to fathers, so that they do an almost a rota, like a relay system, so that they can be with their child. Because if a child has mental difficulties, basically that kind of one-on-one time where the parent is less stressed and not pulled in two directions by work and childcare can be incredibly healing. So on a bigger picture, I think we just need to find ways as families to kind of engage more with our teenagers when they get into the situation. I mean, we can't rely on the government or CAMHS or social workers to pick up slack. As parents, we need to be that army, but we also need to be aware of what benefits, what entitlements, and how to make that work for our children.
It's interesting because you spoke to some interesting people in your piece. There was the woman who got the phone call from the GP to say she couldn't leave her daughter at home, 14, because she was planning to take her own life because she was being bullied at her private school. But this mum, because she ran a big business, didn't think, felt she had to be at work.
Yeah, no, I mean, Suzanne is an amazing big picture person on this. She set up a charity called Parenting Mental Health, and she hears the experiences of tens of thousands of women in this country who are facing that same juggle between work and caring for a very, very seriously mentally ill teenager. So, yeah, I mean, she ended up taking off eight months, and she was very lucky to be in that position. I'm not saying that everybody can do that, but I just think we really do need to shift the conversation into how to address this crisis, because, you know, waiting lists for services like CAMHS are up by a third. You know, the infrastructure just can't cope. So I think the piece that I wrote is not a begging bowl to the government, saying, okay, let's give the parents of teenagers as much money as we're giving the parents of newly born children. It's not that. It's actually an attempt to shift the conversation and to look at what we can do to kind of fix this epidemic, and parents are an important part of that, and they need to have the flexibility to be able to do that.
So on practical level, Tanith, I mean, Suzanne mentioned this in the piece, she could have applied for carer's allowance and her daughter could have claimed a disability living allowance. They're not huge amounts of money, but it would be some help if employers were unwilling to be responsive.
Yeah, and the other thing Suzanne suggests is parents being more eligible for statutory sick pay in these periods and just having that financial freedom or a little bit of financial help to take the time off. I mean, also parents do have 18 weeks of parental leave that they can take at any time during a child's life, but that's also unpaid. So I think with all these sort of different elements that are in the system already, that many more parents than realise can actually make this work.
If they're listening to this, Tanith, and they think, oh God, this is me, is there any way you would recommend they go? Is there a website they could look at? Is there Suzanne's charity? Is that something they could just look at and at least feel they can perhaps pick up the phone or email someone who they can talk to?
So Suzanne's charity, it's also a Facebook group. It's got 22,000 members, women and, well, mainly women, but sort of mums and dads, but sort of talking very, very candidly about how they're coping with looking after suicidal kids who won't come out of their rooms, kids who've got serious eating disorders. It's incredibly bracing reading, but it's an incredibly supportive community. So if anybody's in that situation, I really warmly suggest that they go over to Parenting Mental Health and join that group on Facebook. But, you know, Andrew, I think beyond this, we also need to look at why, at the bigger picture of why our children are in crisis. I mean, unless we address this, you know, why are UK children in such distress? And I think we need to look at the education system. I think we need to look at the size of our schools. I mean, many of the children of the parents that I spoke to, they had suffered this crisis when they got to secondary school, because the secondary schools were sort of like had 1,500 pupils. They were completely depersonalized. No one even knew they were there. They had this incredible academic pressure to succeed. You know, our children are the most tested in the world, publicly tested in the world. And we need to look at actually what's going wrong for our kids, you know, rather than just putting a sticking plaster over it.
We haven't even mentioned the horrors of social media, Tanith.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, as I'm the author of the book, What's My Teenager Thinking? And, you know, when I do a lot of research, and our children in the UK are among the heaviest users of social media, you know, and the research conclusively proved, you know, why, well, under an hour of social media use is good for your connections with your peers. Over an hour, every single hour that child is more on there, the more sort of detrimental mental health impacts kick in. So I think as parents, we also have to look at limiting that space, and we also have to be with our kids more. Now, that's easy to say, but, you know, I think in the UK, we live in a very, very stressed society. There's a lot of pressure to meet costs. We live in a very competitive society. We have some of the longest working hours in Europe. So we have to look at what our social infrastructure is and what it's doing to our children.
I think we do. I think you're right. That's Tanith Carey. She's the journalist, and she is the author of What's My Teenager Thinking? That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to this show all over again. It's the Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, in fact, and good night.